Questioning Medicine listeners, before we get into today's show, I just want to say that this topic that I'm going to talk about, I talk about for the entire episode. There are very few times in which I talk about one topic for an entire episode, which just goes to speak of how important I really think that this is. I'm certainly not claiming to be an expert on this topic. In fact, I know many of the listeners that are going to listen to this have way more expertise on this topic than I do, but I am much more of an expert now than I was before I started the research for this episode. The opioid use epidemic, or opioid pandemic as you might even call it, is having no end in sight. There is no magic pill that's coming. We are it. We, as in all providers, yes, OBGYNs down to family practice doctors, we are it. It's going to take a group effort in order to stop what we started a long time ago. And I'm always looking for feedback. So if you have any tips, tricks, comments, anything you'd like to mention, please email me, AndrewBuelt, B-U-E-L-T, at gmail.com, and I would love to hear from you. Please, try to make it all the way through the episode. Try to really learn something from this, and try to incorporate this into your practice. And with that, and without further ado, let's get on to the episode. Welcome back, Question Medicine 2021. This is Andrew Bill down here in sunny St. Petersburg, Florida. Another day, another dollar, another week, another podcast. You know the deal by now. We're going to get in what I'm getting on. We're going to talk about what I'm reading about. We're actually going to break down just one topic today. It is something that I have never, not once, not one single time talked about on Questioning Medicine, and that is buprenorphine. I will tell you, I have avoided this because until recently... Yes, until this year, I was not able to prescribe it. You see, I could prescribe it, but I would have to do an 8-hour course to write for the drug. And I'll be honest with you, my time is precious, and it just didn't seem like something I wanted to do. Did I want to take 8 hours out of my day and learn how to write for this drug that otherwise I should be able to write for? It should come with my DEA license. I'm allowed to write for opiates, but I'm not allowed to write for the drug that will help you if you're chronically abusing opioids. It didn't make sense to me. I was frustrated. I hated it. And that's just the beginning of it. So with that, let's get into this podcast without any hesitation, without any reservation. It is good. It is good. It is good to be back. All right, Andrew Bill. Sunny St. Petersburg, Florida, 2021. Let's do this thing, shall we? You see, just fresh off the press, January 12th, 2021, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services made an announcement. It was a big announcement. The announcement of practice guidelines for the administration of bupropion for treating opioid use disorders. Here are a couple or a few big takeaway points before we break down all else that I think you need to know. That is that physicians with a DEA license are able to do this. Not all providers, not your nurse practitioners, not your physician assistants. This is just physicians with a DEA license. You can only treat patients in your state or in the state that you have a medical license to treat in. And if you're going to prescribe this drug, you can only treat 30 patients. That's right. The exemption to using this or for writing for this drug is limited to treating no more than 30 patients with buprenorphine for opioid use disorders at any one time. ER physicians or hospitalist-based physicians are not included in this 30-patient cap. And only buprenorphine can be prescribed. Only buprenorphine. That means methadone? No. Buprenorphine is what we're going to use now for opioid use disorder. And last but not least, the other bullet that you need to be aware about is that physicians utilizing this exemption shall place an X on the prescription and clearly identify that the prescription is being written for opioid use disorder. Let's now jump in to the evidence. The evidence is overwhelming that this drug works. You can look at the NNT.com. You can look at the Cochrane Review for which they reviewed, but the drug works. An NNT of two for retention in treatment, and that's with using high-dose buprenorphine, which is greater than or equal to 16 milligrams. Things that have a number needed to treat in medicine of two include Viagra and that's about it. There really is not a whole lot that we have that has such a solid and profound impact on the patients that we're treating. And previously, as I mentioned in the introduction, you had to take an 8-hour course in order to prescribe buprenorphine, which was so odd because you didn't have to take a course in order to give opioids. I never had to take a course in order to give oxycodone or hydromorphone. I just went through med school and it came with my DEA. But maybe suspect that the drug companies had their hand in this and they said, well, these drugs that we're letting them prescribe for free and no extra work, we don't need to give them a course for it. But then once they do it and their patients are hooked on it and it's not good for anyone and we know that it's killing people and at least it's associated, I guess there's no real randomized for this, it's associated with increased badness of about everything, we're now going to make providers take an 8-hour course in order to write for the drug that would combat this disorder that we've initially started. That seems a little fishy to me. It seems like just maybe a drug company said, here, let me slide a few millions under the table so that way you don't notice what we're doing here. You don't notice that we're getting people hooked and then we're making it very difficult to get the medication to get them unhooked or off of these medications. Seems pretty shady. But buprenorphine comes with harms and so maybe we should be careful when we write for it. Just like all drugs come with harms. All drugs. Diabetic drugs, they come with harms. Diabetic drugs have risk of hypoglycemia and death. Buprenorphine also comes with harms. It also comes with the potential that you're going to abuse it or become dependent on it. But guess what? As do all drugs. You look back, I don't know, 2 or 3 episodes, and I talked about the SSRIs and benzos. I mean, there are side effects to almost every drug that we have to be prepared to handle. And there's one thing that we can all agree upon, and that is that opioids are bad, and that opioids lead to an increased risk of overdose death. Now, I'm not going to debate the numbers with you. I'm not going to say, well, the number of opioid-related deaths is 90 billion, because it's really hard. Typically, a lot of people say that the overdose deaths in the United States exceed mortality from guns, HIV, and motor vehicle accidents. But there's a lot of confounders there. There's a lot of complex data. If it's a motor vehicle accident, but opioids are on board, was it actually a death in the motor vehicle or was it a death in the opioids? And maybe the person took the opioids, I don't know, 3-4 days earlier, and it had nothing to do with a motor vehicle accident. But where does it get tagged? It's kind of dirty water. And all I can for sure say with 100% certainty is that opioids are bad, and opioids chronically used lead to increased risk of overdose deaths. Now, the best way to prevent overdose deaths is to not prescribe opioids. Duh, that's completely clear. And if you do prescribe them, don't prescribe a whole bunch of them. Your patient doesn't need 20, 50, 100 pills to go home with for their acute pain. If they have acute pain, they have a broken bone, they have cancer, they have some reason to have really bad pain, then give pain medication. If a person has hypertension, we give them hypertension medication. If they have diabetes, we should give them diabetic medication. If they have acute pain, we should give them acute pain medication, which is opioids. Too often I see these medications withheld from individuals because, oh, you're going to get hooked on them. No. A small dose of medication appropriately given for appropriate indication is appropriate. That's what you should do. It's inappropriate to not give that medication. There is no other condition in the world that we look at and say, oh, you have diabetes? I'm not going to give you this diabetic medication. Oh, you have high blood pressure? I'm not going to give you. Oh, you have cancer? Too bad. You don't get the chemotherapy. Oh, you have pain? Tough luck. You don't get the pain medication. That's the only thing we do in medicine in which we as providers feel like we are privileged to withhold medication from our patients, and it drives me nuts, as you can probably tell. But let me step off my soapbox here and say that if you do give medications to your patients and they say, hey, I got all these extra opioid medications sitting around because you, the provider, gave me 100 pills and I don't need 100 pills. I need like 2 days of pills. What should I do with my extras? And your answer is flush them down the toilet. Yes, you heard me correctly. Flush them down the toilet. And you might be saying, that is crazy, Andrew. You don't even know what you're talking about. I'm going to turn this off right now, except for the FDA agrees with me. Actually, I agree with the FDA because this is where I got it from. The FDA's flush list. Yes, they have a flush list of medications that you can flush down the toilet, and it has to meet two criteria. Criteria number one, the drug is sought after for misuse and or abuse potential. Criteria number two, the drug can result in death from one dose if taken inappropriately. Let's be clear. Don't give a whole lot of drugs. If the patient needs opioid drugs, then give it to them. And if they have extra, then your patient should flush it down the toilet. And opioid addiction, if that is what it comes down to with your patient, is not a failure of willpower. It is a disease. It's a disease of a deranged brain chemistry. It's a misfiring of the neurons, if you will. And the treatment for this disease or this brain chemistry is an opioid agonist. It would be like saying major depressive disorder is a failure of willpower, or any mental health condition, really, for that matter. Getting people off opioids is huge. People who transition to medication-assisted therapy, which is basically taking buprenorphine or methadone, benefit in all sorts of ways, but mainly they stop overdosing, they stop dying, they stop spending all day, every day looking for their next high or hit of drug, and they stop living in fear of going through withdrawals. They stop injecting with street drugs and dirty needles. They stop ruining the lives of theirs and their families. Getting individuals who are addicted to opioids off opioids is a good thing, and buprenorphine is a good drug. Sadly, it is hard to get buprenorphine, even if you want it. In this paper titled, Access to Office-Based Buprenorphine Treatment in Areas with High Rates of Opioid-Related Mortality, an audit study, they used secret shoppers, yes, secret shoppers, to contact 6,000 physicians, but they were only able to get a hold of 469 offices. That, right off the gate, is a terrible rate of getting a hold of people. We're about 8% right off the bat. We contact 6,000, but we can only get a hold of 460. And then out of those, only 54% of Medicaid callers and 62% of self-pay cash payments were allowed to make an office appointment or were offered an office appointment. The secret shoppers were on the phone and they said, hey, what's the like? I really want this drug. I'm a heroin addict. I want to start on buprenorphine. This is two things that we should do. The patient is admitting their addiction. They're admitting they want to start on buprenorphine. What's the possibility of me getting buprenorphine during this first appointment? Meaning, can I get the buprenorphine right away? Can I get the drug that I need right away, which we should give them because they meet the criteria for it? Or are you going to make me go do a bunch of blood work, maybe EKG, blah, 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 come back in 6 months, and then I'll give you the buprenorphine? And when they asked that question, it was shown that only about half of the time was an individual actually going to be given a drug. But you have to remember, it was half of a time and only half of a time were they allowed or offered an appointment. So it's actually 25% of the total calls were offered an appointment and told that, yes, if you need the medication, you will be able to get the medication upon your visit. So when you can only get a hold of doctors 8% of the time, and then you are only given an appointment 50% of the time, and then only 50% of the time are you told that you can get a drug that you are wanting and appropriately deserving for this appointment, it means that only 2% of the time when you are trying to do the right thing as a patient and you are up the creek without a paddle. And you know what creek I'm talking about without a paddle. The patient wants to do right. They want to be on the medication. They don't want to be addicted to the drugs and they can't find someone to prescribe it for them. And it used to be that there was this whole thing, class, 8-hour class we had to go through, but not anymore. And that's why I'm talking about it today. But the stigma around substance abuse or opioid use disorder is very real. And when a patient is trying their best to get on the best medication we have with a number needed to treat of 2, it is on us to help them when they need help. I think my better brain would say that we should help all patients. And I would probably say we should only help patients that really want our help. And no matter what side you agree with, me or her, I think we all agree that substance use disorder patients deserve our best. And if they're trying to get better, they're trying to be well, then we should try our best to help them. Now, this is the Questioning Medicine podcast, so what would be the podcast without a little questioning medicine? And multiple times I read about buprenorphine, or in my research on buprenorphine, I read something to the effect of buprenorphine is a partial opioid agonist, which means that there's a ceiling effect to both its euphoric and potential toxicity, and that makes buprenorphine super safe on overdoses. I thought, okay, that's cool. But then I would also read something to the effect of the preferred preparation is the combination of buprenorphine and naloxone, trade name Suboxone. The naloxone component is completely inert when Suboxone is taken under the tongue as intended. The naloxone only acts as a mu receptor antagonist when the drug is injected. The purpose of naloxone in Suboxone is only to prevent abuse by injection. It has no other effect. End quote. And I will tell you, I thought to myself, well, isn't this awesome? Isn't this just fantastic? This is amazing. We have a drug that is so smart, it only attaches to the receptors in one form and not the other. A drug so smart that it will prevent you from abusing the drug and getting high or getting a euphoric effect. A drug so smart, it almost seems like magic. It almost seems like it's too good to be true. And my index of suspicion was spot on. It turns out much of our belief is based on just potential mechanisms and some drawings, not really the hard evidence when you look at the papers. And that is no more clearly seen than in this paper titled Acute Effects of Intramuscular and Sublingual Buprenorphine and Buprenorphine Naloxone in Non-Dependent Opioid Abusers. Now, let me say one thing before I talk about any of the studies around this, is that the studies are really small because it's very difficult to get a huge group of people and randomize them to buprenorphine, randomize them to hydromorphone, randomize them to these drugs that we know do have side effects. So in order to do a trial, it kind of has to be a small trial. It's just the nature of it. It's the only way you're going to pass an ethics committee. And you don't need a large amount of people to find a difference here, because you're really just looking for, hey, did you get high or did you not get high? And if all eight people said, no, I had absolutely zero effect on me, and then you pretty much have your answer. I mean, sure, there's going to be wide confidence intervals, but how many people do you really need to subject to IM injections of hydromorphone or buprenorphine and naloxone before you have your answer? Well, in this study, they used eight non-dependent opioid experienced volunteers, so eight people that didn't really have any experience with opioids, and they either gave them buprenorphine for 8 or 16 milligrams, or they gave them buprenorphine naloxone, same doses, or they gave them intramuscular hydromorphone, or they gave them placebo. So we have four different arms you could be giving this participant. And it was a double blind, double dummy design. Absolutely perfect. No one knows who's getting what or who's getting where and when. All they want to know is that you're getting something. You just don't know whether it's hydromorphone, buprenorphine, buprenorphine naloxone, or placebo. And buprenorphine and buprenorphine naloxone delivered similar effects to hydromorphone. And the intramuscular administration produced a greater magnitude of effect than the sublingual route, which makes total sense. We would expect that an IM injection will give you more of a high, more of a euphoric effect than just taking a pill. I think we've all seen that in practice before. And I could get into all the charts, but I'm going to get maybe into all the charts in the next article, and that article, the same principles really apply. So I think I'm just going to now read the author's conclusions, which were effects of buprenorphine alone and in combination with naloxone administered intramuscularly and sublingually. The addition of naloxone did not significantly alter the effects of buprenorphine, meaning you didn't get any more euphoric effect, or if you did, you didn't get any less euphoric effect. You got the same effect no matter what. It was a double dummy design, and you really couldn't tell whether you had buprenorphine alone or buprenorphine plus naloxone. But I'm sure that some of you are saying to yourself, Andrew, that's an interesting study, but that was opioid naive individuals, people that didn't really have any experience with opioids. That's not what we care about. We care about the patient coming off chronic opioid use, or we care about the person that is addicted to heroin or some sort of more intense drug than nothing like the previous patients in that study. Well, in this next study titled Self-Administration of Intravenous Buprenorphine and the Buprenorphine Naloxone Combination by Recently Detoxed Heroin Users. In this study, they validated the reinforcing effects of intravenous placebo or intravenous buprenorphine alone or intravenous buprenorphine and naloxone combination in a small group of recently detoxed heroin abusers during a 6-week inpatient study. And while, yes, people who got buprenorphine and naloxone in combination had lower subjective scoring than buprenorphine alone, they had lower scores of having, quote, good effects or, quote, euphoric effects, and I'm putting air quotes and saying quotes in the podcast just so you get, we don't really know what good effects means, but we can decipher what it means. While there were lower scores when you added naloxone to the buprenorphine compared to just buprenorphine alone, it was very close. The buprenorphine alone at 8 milligrams had a moderate, quote, good effect, and the buprenorphine and the naloxone had just less than moderate effect. If you looked at confidence intervals, I'm sure they would go over one another, except for the fact that it was, you know, not a 1 to 10 scale. It was like good, kind of good, really good, sort of good, moderately good. But you get my point here. It was just a little bit less, but it's not like it was zero. It's not like people who had the buprenorphine were like, oh, look at this. I have a really moderate good effect with this buprenorphine alone. And when you gave me buprenorphine plus naloxone, I had absolutely no euphoric effect. It didn't matter that you gave me this naloxone. I couldn't tell that you gave me the buprenorphine because this naloxone just completely negated all effects of the drug. That's not how it works. Sure, it probably reached statistical difference. And depending on your scale, it almost certainly reached statistical difference. But if you're really worried about abuse, if you're really worried about it, then this should factor into how you prescribe. Else, maybe you can kick it off to the side. Of course, you should also think about the cost. And per GoodRx, buprenorphine alone is about $150 for a month's supply, where buprenorphine plus naloxone is about $300 per 1 month supply. Now, the interesting thing is that's cash pay without the coupon. If you have the coupon available, then buprenorphine is about $35 for 38 milligram sublingual tablets, and buprenorphine and naloxone in combination is about $42 per 38 milligram sublingual tablets. The difference between $35 and $42 is only, ding, 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 $7. When I looked this up on GoodRx, I was shocked to see it was only a difference of $7. And I will say that in the future, if it remained a difference of only $7, I would have no problem prescribing the buprenorphine and naloxone in combination rather than just the buprenorphine by itself. Because sure, the buprenorphine does have a higher risk of being abused. It does have a more euphoric effect, if you will. But just by adding the naloxone, it doesn't go away. And if you're really concerned about your patient abusing this drug, then maybe you should have that conversation with your patient, and maybe they're just not ready to quit yet. Maybe this isn't for them yet. I think a major takeaway here is that you should almost certainly, if it's only a $7 difference in your city or your town, you should certainly write for the buprenorphine and the naloxone in combination. The buprenorphine and naloxone is probably truly better. But if you're tricking yourself into thinking you are writing this and there is no way, not one way, that the person that is sitting in front of you is getting high, or that you're writing for this and the person sitting in front of you is not able to inject this and this drug has no abuse potential whatsoever, then you need to start questioning medicine. Nothing in medicine is all, and nothing in medicine is nothing. You're still getting a euphoric feeling with the buprenorphine and naloxone. You're just not getting as much of a euphoric feeling. Nothing is all and nothing is nothing. But hopefully this podcast will help you, yes, you,
write for this medication, or at least feel a little bit more comfortable in writing for this medication, for one individual that is suffering from opioid abuse disorder. Now, the time is ours. We're allowed to do this without having to take this 8-hour course. And realistically, if you're able to help one individual, you will see that it is not as scary or not as dangerous as you might think that it is. And under this new guideline, under this new recommendation, you're able to help up to 30 individuals gain back their life, gain back control of their life, gain back control with their family and with their substance abuse disorder. Before this ship sets sail in a sea of evidence, let's recap some major high points in this podcast. All right, here we go. The classic dosing of buprenorphine that I can find is that on day number one, you give them 4 to 8 milligrams sublingual. And on days 2, 3, 4, 5, moving on, the preferred dose is 16 milligrams sublingual. That is the dose in which Cochrane Review found the benefit for. That is the number needed to treat of 2. We're trying to get up to 16 milligrams sublingual, but 8 milligrams is a good dose for the first day. You're obviously going to want to follow up these patients a lot more closely than you would with other patients, especially if this is going to be the first time you write for it. This new recommendation is for all physicians with a DEA license, and you can only treat patients in your state, and you can only treat up to 30 patients within your state. This rule of 30 does not apply to hospitalist-based physicians as well as emergency department physicians, and it's only for, this new recommendation is only for buprenorphine. It does not apply to methadone, only buprenorphine. And last but not least, physicians utilizing this exemption so shall place an X on the prescription and clearly identify that the prescription is being written for opioid abuse disorder. That is a summary. That is a little snippet, just a little bit of something that hopefully will leave you a little bit more comfortable so you can make a difference in one patient's life like you never could before. And until next time, I'm going to wrap this podcast up as I've wrapped up every one before it. Wait for the music. Until next time, keep the quest and questioning.